The Claude 3 model family by Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. Haiku is lightning fast and cost effective, Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed, and Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Learn more at anthropic.com/Claude.
This is Barron's Live. Each weekday, we bring you live conversations from our newsrooms about what's moving the market right now. On this podcast, we take you inside those conversations, the stories, the ideas, and the stocks to watch so you can invest smarter. Now, let's dial in.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Barron's Live, our daily webcast and podcast. I'm Lauren Rublin, Senior Managing Editor of Barron's. Thanks for joining us today for a discussion of the life sciences landscape. We'll hear from two great speakers, our lead healthcare reporter, Josh Nathan Cazis, and Joel Marcus, founder and executive chairman of Alexandria Real Estate Equities, a REIT that owns, operates, and develops life sciences and technology campuses in key cities across the U.S. Alexandria was a garage startup that today has a market cap of more than $22 billion. It's based in Pasadena, California, and its stock is publicly traded on the New York Stock Exchange under the ticker ARE. Shares are up 15% over the past 12 months, and they yield 2.6%. It's not often that I get to talk about two of my favorite topics, healthcare and real estate. So let's get started. Welcome, Josh and Joel, and I'm glad to have you on Barron's Live.
Glad to be here.
And great to be here as well. Thank you.
Wonderful. So I'd like to start with the COVID landscape. The pandemic is easing in parts of the country, but it has by no means lost its grip on us. So Josh, could you fill us in, please, with an overview on where things stand now?
Sure. So, you know, the U.S. is still averaging about 55,000 new cases a day. The New York Times' case tracker actually says that today it's been flat over, new case count is flat over the last 2 weeks, which is pretty remarkable.
Yay.
Because we had really been, well, but we'd been on a downward trajectory, and now we're, the new cases are not dropping. We're sort of staying the same. The good news is that, the relatively good news is that deaths are dropping faster. There's been about 545,000 deaths in the U.S. so far. Globally, new cases are up over the past 2 weeks, and that's seen new lockdowns in Europe. The vaccination campaign in Europe has been lagging. 13.7% of the U.S. population isn't fully vaccinated as of, I believe that was yesterday. In the EU, only 3.2% is fully vaccinated.
We'll get to Europe when we start talking about some drug companies, but those are all interesting statistics. So, Joel, you mentioned when I spoke to you recently that you see several mega trends emerging from the COVID pandemic, including a move to repatriate drug supply lines to the U.S. How has that been playing out?
Yeah, so I think before I answer that question, useful to put it in context, there are 10,000 known diseases to humankind, kind of amazing, and only about 500 have addressable therapies. And so as we try to figure out how we accomplish addressing through diagnostics, prevention, cures, the 95% that we really have been elusive, we have to think about how we create medicines from research to development to commercialization and on to manufacturing, and how we secure those supply lines. And obviously COVID-19 shined a very bright light on our supply line problems here in the United States. If you go to the most basic issue of PPE, during the early days, it was rumored that China had really kind of cornered the market on it because it was trying to protect its own citizens, and it was hard to get masks. We got about we had a special shipment because we have an operation in China of about 100,000 masks early on in late March and early April, and we delivered those N95 masks to a host of hospitals in LA and New York City, and a couple of other locations, but. It's critical that American healthcare companies that are providing medicines and other critical equipment kinds of supplies have the entire really supply chain under their own control, as opposed to being dependent on third parties. That's been one of the key challenges. And then I think as you look at the future of medicine, personalized medicine, in other words, not treating everybody with a single medicine, but crafting medicines to be respective of each person's individual DNA, so it can be much more effective, and where it doesn't work, you don't take it. The biology revolution that we're now in the early days has revealed that, the other big trend coming out is next gen medicines, gene therapy, cell therapy, where the body is really turned, used to turn against these pathogens and so forth, and how we develop those and how we manufacture them become critical to our health as a society here in the United States.
And Alexandria certainly plays a role in that with the kinds of facilities you operate.
Well, we do indeed. And one would imagine that, these two big mega trends, one is, again, repatriation of supply chain. And then the second is the future of next gen, medicines. Our real estate, which is essentially the laboratory platform, scientific research. Those of you who were, took biology or chemistry in high school or college will remember the labs. They're different than offices. They generally have much more healthy environments. And ours operated throughout the entire pandemic 24/7 on the ground. So, and you can work from home for what we do as white collar workers, but if you're a researcher, you can't do science in your home.
No, not in this house anyway. So a massive amount of money has poured into healthcare and life sciences in recent years. And I'm curious what you see as the investment outlook from here.
Yeah, that's a critical issue you raise. The five principal drivers of the biotech and pharma industry, the so-called what we call the life science industry, which has really become kind of the savior of humanity over this past year. And I urge, everyone to look at Alex Gorsky wrote a really great op-ed over last weekend about the free markets and the invention and innovation society. Really, really good work. But I think it's fair to say the drivers are the NIH provides over $40 billion a year to basic biomedical research. Philanthropy, which used to be a small part, now provides over $30 billion a year to biomedical research. The combination of private markets, private equity, and venture capital, the public markets, IPOs, secondaries, et cetera, they hit all-time highs during 2020 to provide the industry with the fuel it needs to grow. The FDA is critical. It has it approved, I believe, something close to well over 50 medicines last year, and has, I think, already approved 20 this year. So a favorable regulatory environment is critical. And then biotech and pharma companies themselves invest hundreds of billions of dollars per year in these life-saving new therapies. So that's the fuel that's really driving the industry.
And what key areas do you think investors are going to be focusing on as we look ahead?
Well, for sure, I think next-gen manufacturing, because it is, in fact, almost integrally tied to research. So that's become one of the true hot areas. Cell therapy, gene therapy, the new therapies that can go after rare and unusual diseases. They can also be essentially customized to treat individuals. Some people react well, some people don't react well to medicines. Any of you, it's kind of a joke when you hear a pharma ad on television, it'll say, take X, and then it says, by the way, advise your doctor if you get A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, G, J, K, L, M, and all these terrible things, and you wonder, oh my God, if you take the medicine to help you on X, you've got 13 different problems that you might have.
More medicines needed.
Well, better medicines, ones that are personalized to the DNA of the recipient and use the body's own systems to fight disease. So that's where we're really headed. That's really the future of medicine.
It's very exciting. I just want to mention, for those who missed it, you were referring to an interview with Alex Gorsky, who's the CEO of Johnson & Johnson, and it appeared in last weekend's Wall Street Journal, our sister publication.
Indeed, correct. Yep.
Okay. Josh, you had an interesting story this morning on Barron's.com, and you noted that biotech stocks have been down sharply this week. The Spider S&P Biotech ETF, ticker XBI, was down almost 6% on Tuesday and 5% on Wednesday. And you quoted Brian Abrahams, an analyst at RBC Capital Markets, who wrote that the regulatory environment could be getting tougher for the sector. So what's going on here, and what is an investor to do about that?
So I think this is an interesting theme, and I think it's something that we'll be writing about a lot in the coming days. I should say that there's some sense that this particular slide began because of a note by Jeffrey Porges at SVB Leerink, who readers may remember was on our call a couple of weeks ago. And as of today, that ETF, which is a pretty good way to or a good index for biotech generally, was flat. So the specific slide may be over, but the broader point is that there does seem to be a sense that the regulatory environment could be changing. And there's a lot of items at play here, and may not be a time to go into all of them, but, you know, just very briefly, there's been a series of surprises from the FDA over the past couple of weeks, drugs that were expected to get approval in the short term, either I got decisions delayed, or the FDA did other things that sent stocks down those particular stocks down pretty dramatically. Separately, the Federal Trade Commission has made a statement that they're planning on taking a harder look at pharmaceutical mergers in the context of antitrust, and you know, that could have an impact on the kind of big pharma mega mergers that we've seen over the past few years, but also on smaller mergers, you know, large companies acquiring biotech firms with which they have some overlap. And then finally, you know, drug price legislation has been an overhang for this sector for many years. Generally hasn't happened despite agreement between Republicans and Democrats that there should be some sort of new legislation on this. And there are there's a sense that that this is coming back, and a number of the proposals that have been out there are going to be resurfaced. Now, Abrahams had a particular set of prescriptions here. He said it's time to be better stock pickers as opposed to going for the sector at large. His picks were Vertex, which we've spoken about recently. That's a pharmaceutical company that's seen its shares fall pretty sharply over the past few months, but lots of analysts, including Abrahams, are very optimistic on its chances. And secondly, Gilead, which Abrahams also has a high opinion of.
You had a good piece on Vertex a couple of weeks ago in Barron's, as I recall.
Yeah. And the story there is just that this is a company that had some pretty disappointing drug news related to a trial that read out in October, and the stock fell really far. And the consensus among analysts seems to be that it fell farther than is reasonable. Its core cystic fibrosis franchise is really strong, and the patents protecting that franchise are going to last for a very long time. And interestingly, the specific disease in which the trial failed in the fall, they actually have a second drug in the same disease with proof of concept data due relatively soon. So the stock has a chance to sort of fix the hole that was left by that failure.
Interesting. All right, before we go back to Joel in real estate, I just want to run down quickly some of the vaccine and treatment news this week. We ought to start with AstraZeneca, which has been the source of all kinds of controversial news. So tell us what's going on there and how it's affected the stock.
Yeah, this one's sort of a head scratcher. I mean, the company said Monday that their vaccine was 79% effective in a phase 3 trial in the U.S. That was better than expected. Other trials of the vaccine, this is their COVID vaccine, obviously, have not had such strong results. Then in the middle of the night, the part of the NIH that deals with COVID vaccines, the part that's run by Dr. Fauci, put out a statement criticizing the data. AstraZeneca said, oh, yeah, this is, somewhat older, but it's not that much different from the data that is somewhat newer, and we'll update this. And today, they updated it and they said the vaccine was 76% effective. So it seems like a huge, huge, that they created, someone created a lot of trouble for somebody over a 3 percentage point difference. Doesn't make a lot of sense. Bottom line, the vaccine seems pretty good, but AstraZeneca comes out of this, I think, with some potentially reputational issues that that may be interesting to track in the coming months.
Well, two things. It's good to know that that our government is working overnight, and the stock has had a rough week here, as you note. But separately, you mentioned some of the problems with the European rollout of COVID vaccines, and I wonder if you can elaborate a bit on that.
Yeah, and this has been a story that's been bubbling for a long time, and this, this has to do, again, with AstraZeneca. You know, there were, I think, high hopes for this vaccine. The EU liked it because it's, you know, it's an EU company, and they had licensed this technology from Oxford, and it looked early on like they may be on a, have been on a, you know, a quicker timeline than some of their competitors to get something ready. There were some manufacturing issues and then some delivery issues, and the bottom line has been there's been months of fighting between the EU and the company. Meanwhile, the UK has had, I think, better luck getting access to this vaccine. So there's a lot of tension regarding, you know, which doses are going to the EU, which are going to the UK, and who gets priority. Just the other day, you know, the EU had said it was going to block COVID vaccine exports. And now today, it seems like the UK and the EU are sitting down to try to work that out so the UK doesn't get cut off, because there are key AstraZeneca factories in the EU that they're relying on. So, as I said earlier, something like 3-4% of the EU population is now fully vaccinated, which trails well behind the US, and rates are rising there, and countries including Germany are considering, you know, a new round of lockdowns,
which is pretty scary, especially because we all want to go back to Europe one of these days.
Right.
So there was some interesting news this week on the treatment front, and I just want to spend a minute on that. I myself am needle phobic, so I was glad to hear that Pfizer is working on an antiviral pill. Tell us about that.
So they began a phase one trial, you know, very early stage trial of an antiviral pill. And this, the idea is that this, for COVID, this would be a pill you would take sort of at your first sign of infection. They are also testing a intravenous antiviral, different compound, and that one would be for hospitalized patients, you know, later in the course of infection. That one is already in trials. The antiviral pill they began testing a day or two ago. So, you know, early days, but this could be part of, you know, the long-term way in which the pharmaceutical industry helps deal with COVID over the next many years.
That would be an exciting development. So thanks for that. I want to go back to Joel in real estate now. But before I do, I want to remind listeners that we will take questions at the end of the call. So please let us know what's on your mind. So Joel, I wanted to ask you, you have developed property clusters in key research centers around the country, including Boston, San Diego, and the Washington, Maryland area, and even a bit in New York. Where do you expect the next major life science centers to form?
So I'd love to answer that, but let me make one comment on the FDA and some of the discussion that was just had. I think what's surprising is that there's been no real designation of an FDA nominee here. Janet Woodcock was the inside candidate that was likely to take hold, but there's opposition because of the opioid crisis. So I also think that's one of the issues that's kind of overhanging the FDA, and we hope they make a good decision. Janet would be wonderful, but whoever it is, we need a great FDA commissioner for this country. So on the question of locations, there's a handy rule of thumb that we developed when we started the company that basically said clusters are really based on four factors to have a successful life science cluster. One is a place. You got to have a place that is compelling. Two is you've got to have a depth of science research and clinical capability. Third, you've got to have management capability, people who can run companies, seems simple enough, but it's hard to achieve. And then fourth, an abundance of risk capital. So if we look, as we look out, we've operated in Seattle, San Francisco, San Diego, the greater Boston area, kind of the Maryland, DC area, which is, you know, the NIH corridor, if you will, FDA corridor, and down in Research Triangle. We entered New York in, I started there in 2001. We won the RFP from Mayor Bloomberg in 2005, and we delivered our center almost 1 million square feet in 2010. But it takes about 25 years. It's a 20, imagine if you're giving birth, instead of 9 months, it's 25 years. That's a long, painful process.
I can't. Yes.
And that's what it really takes. It's a 25-year evolution to really have these four factors, and very few places can. We've been at it now a decade since we opened our center in New York, and New York is still a small and emerging market. It's hard to say where the next real market opens. There are a lot of people that want to be, but it's not clear that any one place has the necessary requirements that I mentioned, all four of those things to become successful. And frankly, companies and institutions and venture are reinvesting in the established markets because there's a depth of talent there. They don't have to travel. So those of people who want to see Chicago or St. Louis or Denver or Boise or Phoenix or places like that, you know, it may be a long time in coming.
What about a place like Austin where everybody seems to be moving?
Well, Austin's got the hottest real estate market, but there essentially is no life science, no real commercial life science down there. It's a pure tech market at the moment. It may evolve. The University of Texas is opening a medical school, but that's a far cry from having, an established and thriving ecosystem. It's just really hard to do. Give you one example that failed a couple of years ago. We were involved when Jeb Bush was governor of Florida. This goes back about a decade. He put, in the days when all the states had great surpluses, he put about $1.5 billion in to try to create a life science ecosystem in Florida, but he made the critical mistake of splitting it up among a number of locations rather than concentrating in one, and literally that whole thing failed. So sad situation.
Concentration seems to be the key. Do you do anything overseas, or are you strictly U.S.-based?
We did have an operation in India, which we sold off because India is a hard place to operate. They don't respect patents, so real novel research doesn't work there. And we started that back in the early 2000s. And then we have one small operation in China. China's difficult, too, because you compete with the government, and, you know, good luck at that. So we pretty right. much focus on the United States. It's a good market for us.
All right. I wanted to ask you about ag tech. You also lease properties to ag tech tenants. And I wonder if you can explain what ag tech is for those who don't know and what's happening in the sector.
Yeah, it's one of the most, I would say, exciting sectors. Think about, you know, human health is two components. One is fighting disease, and the other is good nutrition. And a large number of the world's population essentially live with food insecurity today. So the real name is called the agri-food tech sector, and it's made up of all the stuff that you could imagine on the production side, all the stuff that you could imagine on the distribution side, and then all the stuff you could imagine on the consumer side. And it's kind of soup to nuts. And we started our efforts in agri-food tech back about 20 years ago in Research Triangle, and have been building infrastructure, including laboratories, offices, greenhouses, et cetera. We even do a lot of work in plants that are grown for to produce medicines, including some vaccines and other things, amazingly enough. And we've also done a lot of direct investment in that sector. So we think it's a great sector. Venture in that area has grown tenfold in the last decade, which is amazing. And interestingly enough, though, the public markets haven't really provided much liquidity. So there hasn't been a lot of IPO work. And the other thing is, NIH funding is over $40 billion per year for biomedical research. The USDA supports basic ag research to the tune of $3 billion. So figure that out. And China has made it one of its top five priorities to dominate the agri-food tech industry. That's why they bought Syngenta. That's why they bought a number of big Smithfields here in the United States, the largest pork producer, I believe. So they seem to have it right. They've got their strategic priorities right. And I don't know why we're, you know, the USDA is giving only $3 billion to basic ag research. Can't figure that out.
What are some of the public players in the space?
Yeah, the space is different. In the biotech and pharma arena, you have quite a number of big players, you know, in the dozens. In the ag tech world, you really have just a handful when you have combinations of, you know, Monsanto and Syngenta and, you know, the big players. There's only a handful of incumbent big players, and they kind of dominate the production, the distribution side of things. And so it's hard to be kind of compete and get airtime with these big guys, you know, really managing the world. But I think venture has figured it out. They're going to kind of create a number of new companies that are become kind of the Modernas of ag tech. They're going to have large platforms, going to have multiple shots on goal, and they're going to do really great things. And these giant companies are not going to be, you know, kind of in the way over the next decade like they are today. They're behemoths, and they're just hard to, you know, to make things happen.
Well, I'm excited about that. We'll have to come back to that and cover it on another call or in Barron's. So one more question before we go to listeners. As Josh and I discussed, and as you discussed, policy issues do weigh heavily on the healthcare and life sciences sector. And the government can encourage innovation or stifle innovation. And I'm curious, from your perspective, what are some healthcare policy changes that you would like to see in the next few years to really encourage innovation and the growth of the industry?
Well, I think it's important to keep in mind that I think what Alex Gorsky wrote is really important, to keep a free market going. If we did not have the warp speed effort and bring public-private partnerships together to create vaccines for COVID-19, we wouldn't be where we're at today, a year into the pandemic and people getting vaccines. We'd be waiting another 2 or 3 years. I can't even imagine what that would be like, shades of 1918 in the Spanish flu. So it's important that the free market take hold and that innovation be supported both at the basic research level and the applied research level. I think people like Bernie Sanders and others who are touting, you know, why doesn't the government control everything? Then you go to a Canadian or a European model. In Canada today, you can't get a vaccine pretty much because they don't produce it. They didn't come up with it. And so I don't think we want a society like that. And the answer that a lot of the politicos say, well, there ought to be Medicare for all. Well, we don't need to blow up the private insurance system. It does actually quite well for, you know, almost 200 million Americans. But there are many effective ways to cover the uninsured, the 20 or 30 million people in this country that are uninsured. There are a number of great strategies to kind of get them insured and get them part of the system. So you don't have to throw out the, you know, the baby with the bathwater. It seems like the wrong thing is driving policy there.
Well, some sort of a combination of public-private, which you alluded to, seems to be the optimal approach. We have a question from Victor, and this relates to something we've been discussing. What is the industry going to do to avoid a response like this the next time we have a public health crisis? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think the saddest thing about all this, when you study what has gone on.
We have a little interference on the line there.
Yeah, not sure where that's coming from. But, you know, when we look at decisions that people were making, I think a famous one was, who's now under pretty big attack, Governor Cuomo, back in 2015 decided not to order ventilators. Well, I guess that's a good decision then to waste money on something you didn't think you need since there was no demand for them since maybe 1918. But the reality is we know that it's pretty clear that, you know, real pandemics are out there and we've been able to contain them up till now, but this is one that kind of got away from everybody. And we know that, you know, there are a number of countries out there that are creating biological weapons and they may not have the ability to contain them. So for us to make short-term decisions that cost long-term lives and health of this country is really foolish. So it really has got to start with policymakers and budgets that recognize we have to budget for the it's like buying insurance. You don't want to pay the insurance premium because you might not have a flood or you might not have an earthquake or your house may not burn down, but you do it because you're being prudent and careful. And that's what we need to be doing. It's not rocket science for these policy people.
It'll be a long time before the memory of this crisis fades, that's for sure. We had a question from Hal about your business. How do you look at return on investment?
Yeah, so we're very focused on our cost of capital to try to drive down through our stock price, keeping our stock price high and buoyant and our cost of debt as low as possible so that we have really good margins to invest in, you know, great research facilities. And that's how we kind of think about it. We can't control the world. We can't control interest rates. But give you an example, we just did a financing of two bonds in early, let's see, when was it? Early February. My own view was that knowing that the Biden administration was coming in, they tend to be big spenders, that interest rates were likely to go up and spike given a lot of the things he was touting for the economy. We felt that interest rates were on the precipice of going much higher, and in fact they did. But in early February, before all this happened, all the spikes started to happen, we did I think it was 11 or 12 year bond at 2% and a 30 year bond fixed rate investment grade at 3%. So we positioned the company's balance sheet to be a fortress balance sheet and at the same time to drive down and lock in our cost of capital for the long term.
Which is one reason you've been so successful. Do you have any thoughts about where rates could be headed from here?
Boy, that's I watched a bit of the interview or the back and forth with Secretary Yellen and,
Jay Powell.
Fed Chair Powell, right?
Yeah.
And I was a little nervous because a number of the questions kept coming back to debt to GDP. How are we going to service debt that keeps climbing? And, you know, we're spending these large amounts. We've added to the national debt in the last year or so, $6 trillion, which is astounding. And I'm not sure we've generated much in the way of GDP or making this economy capable of withstanding. So I'm kind of negative. My first mortgage was under President Carter at 17%. So I have a very vivid memory of poor economic management. And I would say we've got to be very careful that we don't overborrow because you have a situation where this country's economy is potentially going to either slow or stay more stagnant if we don't really focus on free market opportunities and incentivizing innovation. And China is going to be moving. They are so focused and so directed on being the dominant economy and being the controller of manufacturing across the world that, if it turns out that they end up eating our lunch and we become kind of a high debt to GDP country like some of the Europeans are, I think the best days of America could be over. So we've got to make great policy decisions so we don't put ourselves in that position vis-a-vis China or the rest of the world. Critical, critical.
All good points, but don't sell America short. So let's leave it there. I really thank you for your insights today. It's been a fascinating conversation. And thank you, Josh, for giving us an update on what's going on in the COVID world.
Yeah, thanks very much.
We thank our listeners as well. Thanks for tuning in, and please come back tomorrow. You'll hear from Catherine Scarborough, a leading luxury real estate agent with Engel & Völkers and a fifth-generation Austinite. Speaking of Austin, she'll be speaking with Becky Strum, managing editor at Mansion Global, to discuss the white hot housing market in Austin, Texas. So hope to hear from you then. Thanks again, everyone. And thanks again, Joel. It's been a pleasure.
A real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.
What do the most successful growing businesses have in common? They're working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.